All right, good morning again. The court calls United States versus Tunstall. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Mr. Baker, honorable judges of the court, may it please the court.
Just a little louder, please. Thank you.
My name is Major Scott Medlin. I am counsel for the appellant, Airman Michael Tunstall, in the case before you. Before I begin, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. When Airman Tunstall walked out of the courtroom in November of 2009, Your Honor, he faced convictions on two charges for which they were not properly charged, nor were they put on notice. That was the indecent acts and the adultery. As such, the appellant requests that this court set aside those findings and remand them back to the Court of Appeals for a sentence rehearing. Turning first to the indecent acts. The appellant was originally charged with aggravated sexual assault, for the digital penetration of the female when she was unable to consent. At the close of the evidence, the judge sui sponte provided the instruction for indecent acts. Neither side requested that, and neither side objected to the instructions, Your Honor. That instruction was an error, as lesser included offenses of the indecent acts is not included in the greater offense of sexual assault. To get there, we have to apply the prejudicial test found in the plain error test. And plain error, as we see in Jones and Humphreys, tells us that, in fact, if there is an error, whether or not that error was plain and whether or not that error was prejudicial. In this case, we look for error first. And to do so, we look first to the Jones test that this court set out in U.S. versus Jones. And that is essentially the adoption of the elements test, first seen in the Schmuck case in the U.S. Supreme Court. And in that, we look at both the indecent act specification and the sexual assault. And in that case, what we have are two acts. First, both of them were charged that there was an act occurred, a sexual act. And second, whether or not in the aggravated sexual assault, whether or not there was consent. And in the indecent acts, whether or not that act was indecent. Looking at those two compared to one another, they are not similar. And that was the error in the instruction by the judge failing to.
Did you agree that a circumstance could exist where indecent acts was an LIO of a sexual act? So, for example, if they had charged in the specification that this was done in the presence of two other individuals, do you agree that that would change the analysis?
I would, Your Honor. Absolutely. In fact, it is that presence of additional individuals that takes it out from the aggravated sexual assault. Because what we have in the aggravated sexual assault is a lack of consent in an act. The act is similar between the two. It is the digital penetration that occurred. That is similar. So we have to look at the secondary elements, and that is the lack of consent versus the indecency. Now, this court is instructed the military judge in that court martial instructed that Article 120 is not designed to govern the private consensual activity of people. And as such, that was the instructions that he gave the members. As a result, we have to look at what is indecent. So the judge instructed that to get to indecency, we have to apply one of the aggravating circumstances. And one of the aggravating circumstances in this, as instructed by the judge, and the sole aggravating circumstance, as instructed by the judge, was the open and notorious aspect. And thus, the judge was essentially telling the members, to get to indecency, you must find that it was open and notorious. That is not found in aggravated sexual assault. That open and notorious aspect is nowhere seen in the greater offense. Thus, the appellant was never, there was plain error here, and that error was open and it was obvious. Moving on.
Is indecency found or not found within the greater offense?
Your Honor, it is not found in the greater offense. And I break that down by the act is the digital penetration. If 120 is not designed to govern private consensual activity, then we're left in 120 with just the lack of consent. There is no moral judgment, if you will, on the act itself. it is the lack of consent that makes it criminally liable. Whereas in indecency, indecent acts, it is.
I think the question was that can you have a sexual act without the consent of someone without necessarily committing an indecent act?
I'm sorry, could you rephrase that one more time? I apologize.
I mean, I think, and Judge Efron can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think his question was, can you commit a sexual act against someone without their consent because they're substantially incapacitated without committing an indecent act?
Your Honor, if this court is looking to know whether or not the digital penetration act itself is indecent, then that is not before, that was not before the members. If this court is looking as to whether or not lack of consent is indecent, that's a different question than what was posed as a lesser included offense. And that would be, in that case, the act was the digital penetration, that was the indecency in that aspect.
Is that an instructions issue? Is that an elements issue?
Your Honor, in this case, we would argue that it is, in fact, an elements issue. It's not expressly stated as an element.
Well, where are the implied elements in this area?
Yes, Your Honor. If we go back to the language, it is that the individual committed an act, and that act is indecent. And indecent is defined as grossly vulgar or repugnant. And that is it. And those are the two elements.
Right. And so is your argument that a non-consensual digital penetration is not grossly vulgar, indecent, et cetera?
I am not arguing that at all.
Okay. So how do we get to elements here as opposed to an instructional error?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, if we look at the indecency, as it was instructed in this case, and I'm looking only at the instructions in this case, Your Honor, the judge specifically stated that consent was not an issue. He took it off the table. He said, you do not need to find that. All you have to find that the act itself was indecent. And as a result, to find indecency, you have to find that it was open and notorious.
So is the problem here, counsel, that because they necessarily found that she wasn't incapacitated beyond a reasonable doubt, which is why they found him not guilty of the greater offense, that all we're left with is a, at least in theory, consensual digital penetration in the presence of two other people?
Correct, Your Honor.
So how do you describe that problem? Is it an LIO problem? Is it a different theory of guilt problem? Is it an instruction problem? What exactly is it? You can't constitutionalize, what is the problem? Because it's not that the one can't be an LIO of the other.
Yes, Your Honor, it is a different theory of guilt, clearly. In fact, the government, in both their opening and their closing, stated that this act went from, quote, unquote, wild to criminal when she lost consent. As a result, there were acts, essentially, that were, according to the government, in the theory of their case, that were not indecent. It was only when she lost the ability to consent that it became criminal. And that takes it far outside the realm of the lesser included offense. It's a different theory of guilt proposed by the government.
Well, wait a minute. Now I'm totally confused. I thought you were going down the line of, you said it's an elements case, and the elements don't line up. But now you're off in, because you were asked the question of, does the greater offense subsume the lesser? Can there be a digital penetration in public that's not indecent? And you evaded that. I mean, if in fact it's inherently indecent, then why don't the elements line up?
Your Honor, I think what makes it inherently indecent is the element of additional parties present. And that additional parties present is not required in the greater offense. And thus, the elements do not line up in that aspect.
Well, why wouldn't it be that it's when she lost her ability to consent? Why wouldn't that be indecent? Which is what you just said was the government's argument in opening and closing.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the judge in this case took that off the table. He said consent is not an issue. You do not need to find consent. In fact, it is not an element of the lesser included offense of indecent acts in his instructions. So when he took that consent off the table, all he was left with then was an act. And that act then had to be found grossly vulgar.
So that's either a fatal variance or another instructional error But it doesn't take away the, I don't see how it takes away the lesser included offense. It may be that the judge mishandled the lesser included offense, but how do you get, how does this raise the whole range of doctrine dealing with lesser included offenses?
Your Honor, I think the appellate would stick wholeheartedly with the idea that the introduction of the open and notorious aspect takes it out of the lesser included offense realm under Jones, because the elements do not make up. And whether or not that falls under the fatal variance test, that it clearly does. He put the individual, he did not put the individual on notice. It was significantly different than the greater three offense. One could have a sexual, an aggravated sexual assault without consent that's done in the privacy of one's home, or it could be done without the third party presence. So the variance between that and third parties present is significant in the sense that it adds this additional appellate, what almost called a quasi-element at that point, John.
Okay, and what's the case law either in our court or other courts as to quasi-elements?
Your Honor, there is nothing specifically stating quasi-elements, and in fact, the case law we've seen in U.S. versus Adams at 49 MJ 182 and U.S. versus Curtis seem to say that aggravating factors, for example, and those Curtis in particular was a death penalty case, are not elements. And so it goes contrary to essentially what appellant finds himself in here. However, appellant would stress that to find the indecency in this act as instructed by the judge, it had to be that it was open and notorious. Those third parties present is what made it indecent in that aspect. And so without that aspect, appellant can't really aver to any other situations that it may be indecent. Maybe it was done with the intent to humiliate, but I'm not really sure what some of the other additions are.
So if it's not a real element, how does it become plain error?
Your Honor, we go back to the Jones test.
But the Jones test is an elements test, and you've thrown elements over the side, I think.
Your Honor,
I'm still totally confused.
Your Honor, we are essentially arguing that the aggravating circumstances in this case act as an element. They may not be enumerated, but they essentially act as an element in this case. Because but for that open and notorious, one could not find the criminality of this act. It's what makes it indecent.
I just want to make sure I understand what your argument is, right? Which is, you're arguing that they charged him with digitally penetrating someone who was substantially incapacitated, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the military judge instructed them that they could, in the alternative, find him guilty of a lesser included offense which required a digital penetration that was indecent.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he instructed them that if the consensual sexual behavior is not criminal, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that they had to find one of these other circumstances.
Correct.
Right. So they could have found either that he was guilty of digital penetration without consent because of substantial incapacitation, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Digital penetration that wasn't indecent because it was just purely private sexual conduct.
Right, absolutely.
Or that they could find this other aspect.
Correct, Your Honor.
And I think that your argument is not that digital penetration of an unconsenting person because they're substantially incapacitated or whatever the language was is not that would not always be a greater offense of an indecent act.
Right,
but that somehow there was a change between how the government presented the case and how the instructions were given.
Correct, Your Honor.
So that's not, do you see why that's not an LIO issue?
To a degree, Your Honor.
I think we're all just trying to struggle with what is it the issue? What is the issue that you want us to decide? Because you can't disagree that an indecent act is necessarily part and parcel of doing something to a person incapable of consenting.
Correct, Your Honor.
Right, and so that's the elements test. So that's all fine.
Right.
So.
What concerns?
Where's the disconnect? And I think it's the one that I sort of helped you identify, but I'm not sure.
Correct, Your Honor.
But you need to put a label on that problem because it's not an elements problem.
Well, Your Honor, I think that what
unless you want us to hold that one of the aggravating facts have to be charged and tried and identified, which would be asking us to make a change in our case law.
Well, that is certainly an issue that the appellant feels strongly about, that the fact that the addition of these third parties, the requirement that it be open and notorious, be found as a required aggravating element, if you will.
Or is it that the thing that they found him guilty of, that other people be present, is not an LIO of the greater charge?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
So that sometimes it could be an LIO, but in this instance it's not? I'm not trying to help you or hurt you. I'm trying to understand what
Your
argument
Honor.
Is.
Your Honor, I think if I'm not making myself clear, I apologize. But essentially what we are arguing is that there was no notice that this individual had to come into court and defend against the idea that there are third parties present to this aggravated sexual assault. And as a result, there was a material prejudice to him and to his defense. He came in, and his defense counsel came in, and defense counsel did an excellent job, Your Honor, but they came in to essentially attack the idea that there was the lack of consent was a tested theory. Yet what they ended up facing with the instructions was the duty to defend against the idea that there were other individuals present. And that fails under the plain error test because it certainly prejudiced him. The appellant argues that that it's plain and that the lesser included offense, if we want to use that as the language, was in fact a different element. It was under the Jones test, it was different. So we have a different charge here that he had to face against and he was not aware, was not put on notice of.
Would we be here today if the military judge had not mentioned open and notorious at all in his instruction?
We would not, Your Honor. And that is the linchpin of what happened in this case. Moving on very quickly.
Well, what if the original charge had been the one of which he was convicted of? Would the instruction have been an error in this case?
Your Honor, this was an instruction that was not raised by either party. It was done by the judge.
Isn't that the judge's responsibility?
It is, Your Honor. And I see that my time
is
up.
Was there an objection to the instruction?
I see that my time is up.
You can answer the question, please.
And I have one question.
There was not, Your Honor.
So I guess one question for you to address on rebuttal is why that then isn't a waiver or why we're not just thrown into plain error, you know, why you've met your burden, okay, under plain error.
Yes,
and the other question, because again, I'm struggling to understand, this is confusing, right, which is your argument that you can make an act indecent in several ways, and that one of them is one of those ways, which is doing something to an unconsenting person or an incapacitated person, is an LIO, but that there's other ways that you can be indecent, that it's not an LIO of the greater offense, and you can, as I said, address that on rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of the court. I'm Captain Brian Mason, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States. Now, appellant's convictions, both of these convictions at issue before the court, should be affirmed because he had actual notice of the terminal elements with regards to the adultery specification, as well as the fact that the lesser-included offense of indecent acts is, in fact, a lesser-included offense of the alleged aggravated sexual assault in this case. Talking first about the
let's just talk about that for a second. If it had said if the way in which the manner in which this indecent act was carried out, if it had been charged that way, would that be an LIO of the greater offense? I mean, do you necessarily have to have additional people in the room in order to digitally penetrate someone who's substantially incapacitated?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That's not a...
Okay, so why isn't this a situation where an indecent act may be an LIO of the greater offense, but is not necessarily an LIO of the greater offense?
Well, Your Honor, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. My argument is that indecent acts in this case wasn't a LIO of the alleged specification.
How?
Does that make sense, Your Honor?
Well, no, because if it was just a digital penetration, right, without other people present, it's not clear how it is. I mean, That was the circumstances that they were instructed on, right? Which is that there was addition that was open and notorious?
That's one of the instructions they received. That actually, that brings up a good question.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, which is the instruction that he gave that is that they could have found him guilty of on these facts, right? Since consent was taken off the table by them finding him not guilty of the greater offense, right? So what was the fact that they were instructed on that was necessarily conducted if he had been found guilty of the greater offense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that make sense? You understand
my
question?
It does, Your Honor. I think I understand the question. I've commend to the court's review the joint appendix starting at page 302, and I'm going to refer to 302 and 303. If we look at beginning at lines 3, that's where he begins his instruction on the lesser included offense. It essentially lays out the two elements. There's digital penetration, as you mentioned, Your Honor, and two, that the conduct was indecent. Now, appellant's counsel specifically articulated that the judge's subsequent instructions, beginning on line 11 of Joint Appendix 303, lead the members to believe that they have to find open and notorious conduct in order to find that conduct indecent. That's not what the judge's instructions were. If you look at specifically at line 15, the military judge instructed, among possible aggravating circumstances, was that the sexual activity was open and notorious. So, as this court recognized in United States versus Arriaga at page 55 of the opinion,
well, it's not really an aggravating circumstance, is it? It's an element of the offense. Isn't what the judge is saying is that among ways you can find this to be indecent is that it is open and notorious?
Well, Your Honor, this is not an element of the offense. Congress has laid out the elements of the offense, and this was not one of them. The element
counsel. The fact the judge is correctly saying, like, every sexual contact between consenting adults isn't indecent, right? You need, just because you wouldn't do it doesn't make it indecent, right? You need to find something else, and that's what makes it indecent. And then they describe things that equal indecent.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's an explanation of the element, but that is not the element.
The element is indecency, defined as grossly vulgar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, sir.
And the judge is saying you can find the element by virtue of finding various things, including that it's open and notorious.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's not an aggravator. That's an element.
I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Okay. What's the offense if there's no indecency?
Well, obviously there is no offense.
There's no offense. Okay, then it's an element. Maybe I'm getting into a semantic point. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. The point is that if we look at the definition as well, there's a myriad of different possibilities that could result in a finding of indecency applying, as you just mentioned, Your Honor. Here, the charge alleged the act of digital penetration plus the fact that the person was substantially incapable of declining into participation. Now, the members may not have found that they were substantially incapacitated, that the victim was substantially incapacitated beyond a reasonable doubt. But if we look at the circumstances of where that digital penetration occurred, the fact that she's naked, she's at the sink, she's vomiting, dry heaving, essentially retching there, and then the appellant comes up behind and commits this digital penetration, that is, as the CCA correctly recognized, an indecent act. It's impossible to have committed the charged offense without doing what he did there at the sink. That is clearly vulgar, grossly vulgar, repugnant to common propriety, certainly tend to excite sexual desire.
Well, if the door were shut and nobody saw it, how is it indecent?
Your Honor, it's the government's firm position that
Is this always an LIO?
But Your Honor, I'm not going to go so far as to say it's always an LIO.
Okay, is it an LIO here?
It's an LIO here, certainly of the alleged charge.
Well, because indecency isn't an element of the greater offense.
Not in those words, Your Honor, no.
Okay.
But with regards to the charge defense and the way it was committed here, the way it was alleged and the way it was committed, added up to indecency, the fact that he's committing that act in the condition that she's in.
Counsel, I'm having a little trouble trying to figure out what the actual difference here is between the aggravated sexual assault and indecent acts under your argument. And you actually refer to that on page 80 of the brief, where you say that the same facts that are alleged here can be a crime under either one. So first we have the act itself, and then what the question is whether it's indecent or whether or not it's aggravated sexual assault. Based on your comparison, what are the additional elements in the greater offense that are not found in the lesser offense?
Well, what I would argue, Your Honor, is that indecent conduct encompasses a myriad of different possibilities.
Well, in that case, that's almost the greater offense then. If there are specific ones, fewer ones that are contained in aggravated sexual assault.
Exactly, Your Honor. For example, if we do a housebreaking versus burglary analysis, which this court has already done, you have separate intents for a housebreaking, more specific intent with regards to the burglary. Same situation here. More broad range of possible conduct that could amount to indecent, very specific amount of conduct that relates to and would amount to an aggravated sexual assault. So that kind of situation there. And as this court looked at in United States versus Bonner last year, one of the things that the court referenced was the fact that you could take out the essential facts from the charged offense and make it a legally sufficient lesser-included offense. That's essentially what we had to do.
But it wasn't charged. I mean, it wasn't instructed that way. It wasn't instructed as greater offense is indecent and lesser offense. You know, it simply wasn't instructed that way, was it?
I mean, what language are we relying on in the instruction that the members could have found that this is indecency because she was retching into, you know, the sink?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that would excite someone's depraved morals or sexual excitement.
Yes, Your Honor. I would refer the court specifically to the definition that he gave. Now, he didn't call out and reference specific evidence just like that, Your Honor. The military judge did not do that. But he gave the full statutory definition at Joint Appendix 302, lines 14 through 17. And it's the government's position, and apparently the CCA's ruling as well, that the way that was conducted and the condition that she was in was grossly vulgar, was repugnant to counter propriety.
So is it the government's position that consensual sex with a drunk person is an indecent act?
Not always, Your Honor, but when the person is bent over, naked, standing at the sink, vomiting in the sink, yes, Your Honor, that would be indecent conduct.
But we're saying that she had the capacity to consent. I'm just asking. It might not be what you would choose to do, thankfully, but what makes it indecent if that's what they chose to do, if she could consent?
Well, Your Honor, what we know from the member's ruling is they did not find beyond a reasonable doubt that she was substantially incapable of declining the participation.
That's not the question I asked you. I asked you if it was consensual, drunken sex with someone who shouldn't have been perhaps making decisions, but was capable of making them. How is that legally indecent?
I think what makes it legally indecent, Your Honor, was the condition that she was in there at the sink.
But why?
Because of the grossly vulgar nature of committing a digital penetration while the person is throwing up at the same time.
But what if she likes to have sex while she's throwing up? I mean,
it's the government's position that is indecent.
That could never happen. Well, then why didn't they charge her?
Your Honor, I'm not privy to the charging decision in that case specifically. What they charged
is. Do you understand the problem, though? I mean, I'm not trying to make light of this. I'm just having trouble understanding how it's necessarily indecent when the military judge instructed them that private consensual sexual decisions are not by themselves indecent.
I understand, Your Honor. The government's position is that conduct and the condition that she was in renders it indecent.
Okay, yeah. Well,
I understand your position, Jim.
Never mind.
Now, if I may, I'd like to talk about the appellant's argument that there was a fatal variance here that occurred in the case. And all along, the government's theory of the case was that this is aggravated sexual assault, and advanced that through the theory of the case. There obviously was additional evidence presented at trial. There was other individuals present during the time that the digital penetration occurred. That is not, first of all, none of that was new evidence, and I'll talk about why that matters in a minute. But second of all, that's not a fatal variance here. When we determine, when this court looks at variance and decides whether it's going to make an issue in the case, it looks first at materiality and prejudice. And that comes from this court's ruling in Lee, which is cited in appellant's brief. Now, to determine whether or not that variance is material, look at three things. Does it substantially change the nature of the offense? Does it increase seriousness? Increase punishment? And the government's position is the answer to all three of those questions is no. But as the court looked at in Lee on page 16 of the opinion, the court said, considering the question of variance, it must be remembered that even where there's a variance in fact, the critical question is one of prejudice. So I'll talk a little about the prejudice piece. And in this court's opinion in Hunt, page 347, 348 of the opinion, the court looked at several factors to determine prejudice. Looked at the fact that, quote, the state of the government's proof is readily apparent from the witness testimony and other evidence presented at the pretrial investigation under Article 32, in which the defense counsel participated. Further, the court goes on to recognize that the appellant made no motion for a more specific charge or for a continuance. Here is the exact same situation. If we look at Joint Appendix at page 34, you can see that the evidence was not new here. All of this evidence is laid out. The investigating officer talked about that. And again, a trial, no objection, no motion for a continuance. There's no prejudice in this case. Again, it's the government's position that any variance in the case really wasn't. But if the court finds that there was, that was not material, certainly not prejudicial, and therefore no fatal variance in this case. Appellant attempts to point to some prejudice on page 14 of his brief. He talks about that the defense would have changed had he known that he was facing the LIO or indecent acts, but he doesn't say how or changed anything, how or when anything would have changed. Again, this evidence was not new. The defense cross-examined the witnesses on the perception and did so effectively. In fact, I was acquittal with regards to the 107 specification. Later on that same page, appellant talks about, quote, undoubtedly the defense would have spent more time questioning the witnesses about matters not otherwise addressed at trial. Again, no specific references to what they would have asked about or spent more time on that. So, bottom line is there's no prejudice, certainly not under a plain error analysis. He hasn't met his burden, and he's not entitled to believe or finds that there was some variance there. And if I may, if there's no further questions on the panel with regards to Issue 1, I'd like to move briefly to Issue 2. With regards to appellant's argument that RCM 907B1 mandates dismissal of the charge, this court has already addressed that argument less than 6 months ago in United States versus Humphreys, and essentially rejected that argument and asked the court to do so again here. As the court recognized Supreme Court precedent in United States versus Cotton, application of the structural error standards, and with respect to the non-jurisdictional status of defective specifications, the court's determination in Humphreys is consistent with this precedent, and that we'd ask the court just to continue to follow that precedent. With regards to the prejudice under the plain error analysis with regards to Issue 2, there was no prejudice in this case. And I talked about it a good amount in my brief. I'd just like to highlight some of those points in there with regards to the actual notice.
The appellant makes the argument that the mere fact of pleading guilty controverted the element. Was there anywhere where they specifically argued or presented evidence that the conduct wasn't service discrediting or wasn't prejudicial to the order and discipline? Do you understand what I'm saying? As opposed to controversy that they were guilty at all, that they controverted that particular element?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, that was, as defense counsel stated in his closing argument, the most important element, at issue with regards to the adultery specification. During the government's case in chief, did they cross-examine witnesses and elicit favorable information for them, but as soon as we rested, the defense offered an application for dissolution of marriage. And there was this whole discussion between the trial counsel and the judge and defense counsel about why this may be a 403 issue. And defense counsel specifically stated this is going against the third element. It goes to the prejudice, good order, discipline, and service discredit. He acknowledges not only that's an element, but the specific intent of that evidence was to go against that. And then he followed that up in his closing argument. So there is
counsel, do we need anything beyond that in this case? Do we need to have your Article 32 argument and any of your other arguments about the evidence that was introduced when it wasn't specifically referencing the third element? Is it sufficient to rely on what you articulated on page 17, or do we have to consider those other matters as well?
Excuse me, Your Honor. No, to answer your question shortly. The fact that he articulated that directly on the record is dispositive.
Thank you.
Now, given the amount of litigation on this issue and the number of cases still pending, it's the government's position where an Article 32 officer lays out those same elements, that it's no different than a judge doing a trial.
Well, counsel, there's an Article 32 in almost every case, and there was an Article 32 in Humphreys, and that didn't satisfy us there, which I think is what raised the question in Judge Efron's mind. We're asking about what happened during the actual trial. I understand that the Article 32 is part of the overall record, but it's not the trial.
I absolutely agree with you, absolutely. And in terms of assessing error and those kinds of things, I think that's really important. But if we're looking at notice and if we're looking at prejudice on actual notice, the biggest undercutter of notice and that error of failure to allege a specification is the fact that, hey, they already knew. They had actual notice. This seems to be this court's reasoning when the United States versus Ballin came out is, well, the military judge gave that actual notice. So there was still error. The fact that the judge went over the elements undercutted that prejudice piece. And the government's just simply requesting that the court look at that again and make a determination, if you would, about an investigating officer and the fact that he's providing that same information.
But you don't disagree either that that's not the trial or with Judge Efron that we do not need to go there, which is, I know that the Air Force would like us to revisit Humphreys. You've made that very clear.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree with you on all counts. The dispositive issue is the fact that defense counsel says on the record, we know of these elements, here's evidence on it. There's no question that is absolutely dispositive. Unless there's further questions from the court, I'd like to briefly conclude.
Please.
Now, as this court has recognized, appears to, through the questions with appellant's counsel here, this isn't a question with regards to issue one about whether or not the elements, there's a problem on the elements. The elements, as you line them up and applying the Jones test, as this court is very well aware, leads to the conclusion that the indecent acts is a lesser included offense of the alleged aggravated sexual assault. Even if this court finds an issue with variance with regards to the open and notorious and the additional aggravating circumstance there, any variance was not material. It definitely was not prejudicial. Based on that, we would ask this court to affirm the findings and the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, rebuttal, please.
If I may begin, my answer in the question posed before I took my seat as to whether or not the issue was waived. Appellant points to the case of U.S. versus Humphreys to say such issues in these plain error cases are not waived. This was a pre-Jones case, and the case law has changed significantly since Jones and Schmuck. And essentially what we have here is a defense counsel who, when viewing the elements test, possibly may have said that they are substantially similar or under the old test, not aware of the elements test. So potentially may not have objected at that point. But regardless, it's a waiver analysis as opposed to a forfeiture analysis as opposed to a waiver analysis.
Would you address prejudice, please?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you. In terms of prejudice, this is a case in which the individual came in with a defense of consent. His defense counsel continually placed individuals at the scene of the situation and continually put those people, asked them what their knowledge of the situation was and what their view of the whole thing. And that prejudice goes directly against the actual crime of indecent acts. To place them at the scene of the crime, to put third parties there, is contrary to what the defense's, the appellant's interests were. And as a result, he eventually had defense counsel positing to a lesser included offense. only because he was not aware of such a charge to be brought against him. And it was not until the judge instructed it. As a fact, as we stated before, the government's actual theory of the case was it did not become criminal until consent was an issue. As a result, defense was not properly presented and notified of the actual charges against him. Moving on.
So your argument is that he was prejudiced because the theory of guilt was lack of consent, and he was convicted on some other theory, or?
Correct, Your Honor. The theory of the government presented. The defense.
I'm just confused about how the introduction of people bearing witness against him into the trial, which is normally how trials occur, was prejudicial.
Absolutely, Your Honor. In this case, if defense was aware that the open and notorious or the indecency of the act itself was at issue, certainly they could have pursued a different line of questioning, or even not additional, maybe if not different, but also additionally. There was no question of whether or not anyone viewed this as indecent. There was no line of cross-examination or any evidence put on otherwise. I see that my time is completed. If there are no further questions, then.
All right. The court thanks both counsel for your arguments. The case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until further order of the court. Thank you.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.